Let's head to Plainville, Connecticut, where a man allegedly killed his girlfriend and her two children before turning the gun on himself. Police say a woman called 911 over the weekend to say her brother, Patrick King, called her and claimed that he had killed his girlfriend and their four-year-old daughter and that he planned to kill himself. It is the latest tragedy connected to domestic violence here in our state, and it calls for another conversation with Gary McNamara, who is on the board for the Center for Family Justice, which protects survivors and their children in domestic violence situations. He also is the chairperson for the White Ribbon Campaign, which is to help men, young men specifically, to try and tackle domestic violence and end it, because it continues to be a real issue. He also happens to be a former chief of police in Fairfield. So for all of those titles, we come to him with these really awful situations to, I don't want to say make sense of them, Gary, but to just kind of work through them and say, what do we learn from this and where are we sort of at as a state? I don't even know where to begin. I got to be honest. I don't even know where to begin with this one. It's obviously horrible when you have domestic violence deaths, but this one involving children, it takes it to a whole nother level.
Yeah, I don't know where to begin either, Melissa. I mean, you know, we describe this as a murder suicide, but let's just really focus on the fact that three people were murdered in a domestic violence situation. Yes, the suspect chose to take his own life, but really we have three people that were murdered in a domestic violence situation. And it gives us an opportunity to once again talk about that it occurs anywhere, and no one's immune from those situations in any community. We know that it exists, and it just gives us an opportunity to talk about, to dissect this a little bit, and then just really talk about what we learn, what we know, and what we may be able to do to prevent it from happening again.
So if I know you, you heard this case and you did, I'm sure, digging into just looking at the people or looking at if there, you know, was anything that kind of stood out. Did anything stand out to you in this case, you know, prior to, I mean, obviously you're not investigating it personally, but just from your, you know, put your cop sense on for a second, like what stands out to you in this case that we can kind of dive into?
Well, one of the things is that we always go in any of these instances, we look at whether or not law enforcement had any history and whether there was any history reports. And so far, they have not found any. Now, the family apparently just moved into that neighborhood in January. So be interested to find out where they lived before and whether or not there were any reports to law enforcement, or whether or not neighbors kind of can share and provide some or shed some light on the fact of whether or not they knew that there was some disturbances within the relationship. That's the first thing. And then the second thing we look at is we got to talk about the kids, and we got to look at the fact that, and we don't really talk about it a lot. I don't know whether we've ever really talked about this component of partner violence, but this dynamic of family annihilation, where not only is the target the female in this case targeted, but he also chose to annihilate the entire family. And that sheds light on, number one, the dynamics and what must have been occurring in the past, but also the fact that we cannot lose sight of the fact that this is a tragic situation, but there are other domestic violence situations occurring where kids are there and they're seeing it and they're experiencing it, and they're sometimes also victims of it. And that's one of the things that this case kind of highlights, the fact that these poor kids were also targeted in this act of violence.
Well, and so there's a lot to take out of that. First of all, what was the phrase you just used?
Family annihilation.
Okay.
Like the dynamics of family annihilation.
Okay. So that could be translated a couple of different ways. So first of all, obviously the blatant taking an entire family out. I mean, that's kind of like Rhode Island, right? What happened with the Providence ice hockey game where the guy goes in,
yeah,
and
it was his
ex-wife or his wife, their child. And I want to say a grandparent all there at the arena before turning the gun on himself. That's another example of kind of what
exactly
we're seeing.
Yeah.
What about, though, like coercive control, Gary? Because for people, I think it was a few years ago that we passed a law in Connecticut including coercive control as a type of domestic violence in a relationship. First of all, people don't even know what that definition is a lot of the time. So if you could define it really quickly, but also would you call that a type of family annihilation? Because to some degree, no, people kept their lives in those situations, but coercive control also, I would think, hurts kind of the family dynamic, no?
Oh, it does. Yeah. Well, we know. I mean, domestic violence is not just physical. It is all mostly about control. And in cases like this, you know, and again, I'm speaking just generally because I don't know all the specific facts, and maybe we'll find out more. Maybe family members or neighbors or other people will be able to shed some light onto it. But they don't just snap. This individual just didn't snap. This was an example of control and jealousy. And then escalation, that in all likelihood something occurred in that house, either at that moment or instantly beforehand. Maybe he found out something. Maybe he was so jealous that it was a triggering event for it. But that control and that jealousy in relationships like this oftentimes is what starts to build over time. Now you add the fact that he had legal firearms. So there is and it's not uncommon in domestic violence cases for firearms to be used. We know that most of the times when we have deaths in domestic violence situations, a firearm is involved. And when we start talking about family annihilation, it's generally males that will commit that over females. But you can see that, to your point, the jealousy and the control start to build. And at one point, there's a triggering event and the individual is like, I'm going to kill you, and I'm also going to kill. Apparently, the 12-year-old was not his daughter, but the 4-year-old, I think they shared that child. But I'm not really clear on the relationship of the 12-year-old. But it's that jealousy, control, escalation, and then something happens over that time, and that's a trigger where he takes this action.
So we have former police chief Gary McNamara here, who also is on the board for the Center for Family Justice. And he's also the chairperson for the White Ribbon Committee, which, again, is an effort to end violence against women by engaging men in the process of personal, relational, and social change in combating this issue that we clearly still don't have under control. Bringing up the kids in this as well, Gary, because I want to touch on this before, you know, how do we react, you know, appropriately, and how do we make change, which will be the second part of this conversation. But with the kids, you know, a 4-year-old is a little bit tricky because I don't know if this child was in preschool or not. But, you know, how important would you say it is when you see these types of stories? One of the things I've learned from the center over the years is that you have mandatory reporters, but you know, even if it's parents of the friends of this child, or, you know, it may be teachers, you know, whoever it may be, where you identify that a child seems off or a child is, because I would imagine from their standpoint, again, like you said, this couldn't have happened overnight, but something must have stood out to these kids that made that you would hope people maybe spoke up about. And again, I don't know if that matters enough, but the importance of like a call to action, if you see especially kids who are in domestic violence situations or in an unsafe home, what our roles are in the public. I don't know if you could speak to that.
Yeah, I think that this is a good example of that, is that while it is not uncommon, we know this, and you know this very well through all the work you do at the center as well, it's not uncommon for people not wanting to come forward, especially, you know, a victim to come forward because of a variety of reasons. They don't know where they're going to turn, what they're going to do. Their life is really turned upside down. But also, there are signs, and there are things that may be red flags that people might be able to pay attention to. And certainly, since we know that this didn't just happen suddenly, that means that there's the stressors of all of this occurring for probably quite some time. So whether or not she was sharing it with friends, whether she was acting off or sheltered, or whether the kids just were kind of feeling that stress, and whether we could look back and say maybe a teacher, or maybe the kid said something to another classmate or something. Now, again, that's far-reaching. A classmate might not necessarily come forward, but it's always important to recognize that just because people find it hard to report these instances because they're suffering in silence, the signs and signals of that suffering oftentimes come through. And it's just a question of whether or not we have the ability to recognize it.
absolute tragedy out of the town of Plainville, where we do know grief counselors are on hand today for Plainville students after a man allegedly killed his girlfriend and two children before turning the gun on himself. We've got Gary McNamara here talking about this. Again, Gary is a former chief of police. He is also on the board for the Center for Family Justice and is even the chairperson for the White Ribbon Committee, working with college-aged men to try and combat the issue of domestic violence. So this is the part of the conversation, Gary, where I'm certainly not looking for you to be a therapist or anything, but I think you have great insight from a lot of different kind of sectors there to help with different populations of people. I guess first and foremost, yes, grief counselors are super helpful, I think, to have them on hand. What do you suggest for families today who hear this and think, oh, my gosh, this is awful, this is a horrible, which it is. But how do we proactively, you know, again, I think, talk about with our kids what healthy relationships should look like? Modeling that obviously is important as well. But I guess we start there with what would you suggest families to do after hearing a story like this, especially if they do have kids themselves?
Well, I think the first thing is to, first of all, let's just back up 1 second, is that this is probably the most extreme form of domestic violence we can see, that family annihilation, where this individual actually is taking out the entire family. But I think some of the things that we can take away from this is that the kids are oftentimes the victims as well. And so I think that you said it, Melissa, we have to model strong behavior. It is not enough for me to say that I will not mistreat a woman. I have to make sure that other men and boys understand that as well. So my job is not just to say I won't do it. I have to make sure that they do it. And I think we can have those conversations about what a healthy relationship is all about, and then show that kind of concern. But I think the big thing, the big takeaway for families is, I watched some of the interviews of some of the neighbors on the news, and they were like, boy, they were just a normal family. I saw them outside. They were riding their bicycle. She was such a cutie. You know, she's just hanging out. That's a good sign for us to learn, is that you're not going to see the signs oftentimes. But if there is ever any concern, if there is ever any word or a sense that you are friends with someone or a family member and you just think that they might be in a complicated situation and don't want to come forward, you don't need all the proof. You just have to say, I'm just a little concerned.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, and I'm a little bit jaded from working in television for so long, and I get it. You're pulling for strings, basically, when you talk to the neighbors. But I mean, just to be clear, I'm in a very safe marriage and our household is fine. I'm not saying anything. But like my neighbors would say the same thing. They'd be like, oh, yeah, they run up and down the driveway. He's a cutie. I think the neighbors are not a great gauge, which I know you know that. But to your point, you know, I certainly wonder what family members, what people are going to say. Because the other, you know, question I have for you, Gary, honestly, and this is not a criticism of you, obviously, but I mean, what effectively can you do? I mean, so you hear about these things, and yes, we could certainly speak up about it. We certainly can have a restraining order, but far too often, the signs are all there. People say things, but that's actually the most dangerous time when you are in a relationship that you're knee deep with a dangerous person. And the second that you want to take action, either getting away, calling somebody, letting someone know, or filing a restraining order, that's usually when the attack happens. A lot of the time, not always, but a lot of the time. So what, I mean, do you think from a law enforcement standpoint, either there are more things we could do, passing laws or having a better justice system? I don't know. Or is it really that you just don't get to a point where you're in that dangerous of a relationship, which is, again, talking more about generational, you know, making, you know, better relationships and certainly identifying at a younger age what is appropriate and what's not. I mean, what is sort of the solution there? Because it is frustrating the amount of times you'll hear about, yes, we did all the things. We spoke up. We have the police reports. I don't know about this case, but you know what I'm saying? Like the amount of times you'll hear about, yeah, we had the restraining order. We got the kids out of there. We did all the things and it still happened.
Yeah, no, I know you're right. And, you're right. That's why we always try to focus on preventing in the first place. And there's a lot of, you know, work we do on that side of it. But you're right. Once they're in it, it's very hard to get out of it, especially when there are firearms involved. You know, Connecticut does have some laws that police officers can, under the right circumstances, do a search warrant and seize those weapons if there's an indication that the relationship is not a good one. I mean, there's obviously more to that. But in cases like this, she apparently never came forward. So, yeah, it is very, very difficult to do. But I think the key is that just because it's difficult doesn't mean we can't try. And the point is, don't, if you are concerned enough about somebody, there are some resources. Call anyone, the Center for Family Justice, or call, you know, the state. The state has its 24-hour network and a hotline that you can call. It's called Connecticut Safe, CT Safe Connect. And you can call and just say, I'm a little concerned about it. But, yeah, these are very difficult situations to get. To get out of safely. But here's the key, Melissa, and you know it because we've seen some of the speakers that we've brought in. There are ways in which people have successfully left bad situations.
Yes.
The key is to get someone comfortable enough to report it and confident enough that at least they can report it, and then you can work out some sort of a safety protocol and a safety plan. These are not easy situations to get out of. Obviously, in this case, tragically, she and her family all lost their lives, but it doesn't mean that we can't continue to do that. But I think the key is, don't ignore a friend or a family member that comes forward and kind of gives you or shows you some concerns that my husband or this person was a little angry or what, or gives you symptoms that there might be some bigger problem. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is, you can call and say, listen, I'm not the victim. But you don't have to be the victim to call and learn more about it. And then begin to gradually find ways in which you can support that person, develop a safety plan, and have a plan to get them out safely or report it to the police. You know, maybe, you know, who knows? There are times when we get reports and police respond and they seize the weapons, so at least we get the weapons out of the house, and maybe there's things that can be done in that way. But yeah, we've talked about it. Restraining orders, they are only one thing. They don't work to protect somebody, as we've seen in the Milford case about 2 years ago.
That was horrible.
These are not easy. But the first thing we have to do is understand that they're not easy, and we have to understand that they do exist in all these neighborhoods throughout the state. And there are ways in which we can at least shed some light on it, be compassionate of people, and believe them when they tell you that they're worried in their relationships, and call to see what you can do as a friend to maybe start getting that support for them.
Mm-hmm. And we're actually going to put a couple of links to different places for resources, including, as Gary had mentioned before, the CT Safe Connect, and more information for the center and everything. We're going to attach that to Gary's podcast on our website, voiceofct.com. Gary, thank you so much. And again, we will continue to follow the case out of Plainville. And as soon as we have more information, we'll share it with you here on WICC.